C'est final.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Tennis, the new tennis podcast with your host, Keith Fraser. Yes, that's me. And my sidekick and former British number one, Mr. John Lloyd. Yep, welcome to another episode of Rock and Roll Tennis. As always, I always say it, I'm with my main man, Mr. John Lloyd, who actually, I just saw him in his car with his cool shades on. He was looking the part. John, how you doing?
Good, very good, yeah. Just drove from Palm Beach, you know, just someone's got to do it, you know, just to get back here in time in Lauderdale by the sea here, just to chat with you lovely guys, although July 4th, we've been told now that they're going to close the beaches again for 3 days. So I'm not too happy about that. So I'll have to put away
the stuff.
Close
the tennis courts, John.
July 4th, Super Saturday here, JL.
Super Saturday. Yeah, very true.
Well, listen, we haven't introduced our guest. I mean, you may have recognized him by his voice. But he, look, today we're recording this on what would have been the first day of Wimbledon. And we've got a Wimbledon legend with us. Well, two Wimbledon legends with us, of course. And, you know, this guy, number 8 in the world in singles, 52 titles on the tour. He's a legend, isn't he? He is, of course, London-based Mr. Peter Fleming. Peter, this is a great pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on.
No, thank you. It's my pleasure. Nice to speak to anyone anytime these days.
Yeah.
Before we start, Peter, 2 weeks ago, John's written a book. He's got so many great stories. And he was about to divulge a story that he had involving your good self to do with a program on TV here in the UK called The Question of Sport. I'm going to hand it to you, John, to tell us a story.
You know this story, don't you, Peter?
I think I do. I think I was there.
Well, you were kind of there. You were there taped. But, Peter was... I was in Question of Sport. First time I've ever been on the show, and I was a bit nervous about going on until they told me it was going to be only a tennis panel and only tennis questions because, you know, now I've lived in the States for 30 years. I don't know much about British sports, to be honest. You know, rugby, cricket. I just don't follow them. And I was thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to... So anyway, they finally put an all tennis event on during Wimbledon. And I was lucky. I was in the panel with Martina Hingis and Tim Henman was on my team and Virginia Wade was on the other. I can't think who the rest of the people were. But anyway, I didn't say too many bad things or wrong things. I think I got a couple right. And it was all, and it came down right to the end where the last question or the one before the last, and it was touch and go in terms of the two teams, was the mystery guest. And only about a week or 3 days earlier, I was at Queen's Club hitting some balls and a friend of Peter's and mine called Martin Lee just happened to stop by. And I said, oh, how are you, Martin? And he said, good. And so what have you been up to? He said, oh, this and that. And he said, oh, I saw Peter Fleming yesterday. And I said, oh, really? I said, how is Peter? I haven't seen him for a few days or a couple of weeks, whatever. And he said, yeah, he just did the mystery guest spot for Question of Sport. And I said, oh, really? And I think it didn't go into my mind then because I thought they'd tape those things and, you know, a long time in advance and it would be on a future show. So anyway, it comes down to the crunch and the mystery guest comes up and, you know, they put little bits of Peter's face and rest of the body and whatever. And Tim Henman and Martina Hingis go, I got no idea. It was our turn. And I said, you know, I'm not sure, but I think that could be Peter Fleming, you know. And Tim said, nah. Martin Hingis said, nah, there's no way. I said, well, you know, I don't know. I just think it looks a little bit like him. And they said, well, and Tim said, well, you say it. And I said, no, you're the captain, Tim. So Tim said, Peter Fleming, he thought we were going to get laughed at. And sure enough, it was you, Peter, and we won the competition. I never told anybody. So there you go.
You know what? I don't remember filming that at all.
Oh, well, you did.
Of course,
you were on it.
Of course, I don't remember my name most days, so I guess
that. Classic.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
So how many points did you win by? Was it that particular question that got you over the line?
It carried us over the edge. And, you know, just for you people who are listening to this, thinking that someone like Tim Henman, you know, Gentleman Tim and all that stuff, I did tell him afterwards, And I said to him, you know, and he said, really? And I said, I thought he might say, well, I'm not sure I'm that happy with winning over those circumstances. And he said, oh, my God, that was great. I'm so glad you did that. So, you know, Gentleman Tim was a competitor through to the end there and was happy for the cheat on the team, Mr. John Lloyd here, to win the day for the team.
Well, listen, there are in football, people trip themselves up on purpose to get a penalty on question of sport. They do things like that to win. It's all about the winning, I guess, John. But Peter, listen, you are a Wimbledon legend. And you may notice that I didn't introduce you at all about your doubles. I introduced you as the number eight. You got to number eight in the world on the singles, which is no mean feat. It's an incredible achievement. Does it rankle with you a little bit, though, that people like to talk to you about your doubles a lot?
Well, you know, I suppose, as somebody said, you know, at least they remember you for something, you know? So it's, it's just the way it is. It's just the way it is. If I were number eight in the world for 10 years, yeah, maybe that would annoy me, but I was there for a cup of coffee, as they say. It wasn't long before I was back out of the top 10.
Listen, anybody, like I said, we had Todd Martin the other day, anybody to get to that level, your level, John's level, it is remarkable. The amount of players there are in the world to get to that ranking is just, it's an incredible achievement. But you are known, you know, for your doubles largely. Does it bother you at all that people want to talk to you perhaps sometimes?
No.
Often more about your partner than yourself.
Well, you know, come on, the guy's the larger than life character. Everybody wants to know about him. And so, I think it did bother me back when I was playing, you know, when I was still trying to, you know, make my mark in the game, and when everyone just wanted to talk about him. Yeah, that rankled once or twice. But now that we're done, it's like, all right, you know, whatever. At least, no, I understand it.
Can I just ask a quick question? Because I played with Johnny Mack many, many years after that in the senior tournament, and it was only a senior tournament, but in the Australian Open, I've already told this story, I think, to Keith, but he was so competitive then, and I wasn't prepared to play with Mac. I was supposed to be playing with someone else. I wasn't in great shape, and the first couple of matches, I got better, and in the end, I actually played quite well, but I was so bad, and he didn't actually say, you suck, but he certainly gave me enough looks that I knew it, and I was like, oh, my God. So I stood at the net like a bloody statue and just kind of poked at a few balls and let him do the rest. Pete, I was always going to ask you, I mean, obviously, you know, you had good days and bad days like we all did. But when you had bad days, I mean, did he say stuff to you, or did your relationship was like, you know, you just get on with it? Or did he suddenly ever turn around and say, Peter, you suck today, or something like that?
No. The reason why he was such a great doubles player, or one of the main reasons, was that, you know, he was one of those guys that made his partners play better. And so I don't remember any time when you know, he might have tutted when I was facing the other direction, but I've never noticed it, you know. And so it was, because as you say, there were a lot of days when I felt really guilty about, you know, God, I'm playing terrible. This is horrible. But early on in the it must have been in the first 6 months. You know, we lost the match, I remember, and we went out and had a few beers afterward. And I'm really sorry, man. I just played terribly. He goes, listen, we win as a team, we lose as a team. And you know, enough of that. I'm not going to listen to any more of your, you know, your apologizing. And that was a great thing to hear.
Yeah.
Hey, John, if only Mesut Ozil get away with saying that to his Arsenal teammates. Because I tell you, he doesn't seem to do much. But there you go. That's a different sport altogether. But can I ask, Peter?
Who cares about Arsenal? The Wolves are almost in the Champions League.
Yeah.
I hope they do it, as John does, of course. I think you'll do it, John. What do you think?
We've got a pretty good chance. Although there's Peter is a Chelsea fan, and they're not going to be easy to dislodge. But we're playing pretty well, I must say. Pretty impressive.
Just have to come fifth.
Yeah, exactly.
Listen, Peter, I know obviously we're talking on the first day of Wimbledon as it would have been. In your experience, is it the biggest slam as an American? Because you won the US Open a few times, didn't you?
Yeah, you know, Wimbledon is the biggest event in the world, really. I don't think anybody can deny that. Okay, the, some Europeans will say they prefer to win the French, and Americans would say they prefer to win the US Open. But I guess when we played, I didn't like the US Open. You know, it was the facilities were, you know, the organization was just sort of crass, and I just didn't enjoy playing there. You know, being in the city even wasn't that exciting for me. And so I always, from the, you know, I tell a story, the first year that John and I played, and we beat Smith and Lutz in the second round. They were seeded second, and we were nobodies. And the next round, so that was the next match we played was due to be played at 2 o'clock, first match on. And back in those days, the cars drove into the grounds, and at 12:05. Our car, we warmed up at Queens, and the car drove us in. At 12:05, we drove in the grounds, and the grounds opened to spectators at noon. And we were due to play on court three, which was nearly 1,000 people. And at 12:05, there wasn't an empty seat. And so those people, you know, at 12 o'clock just sprinted to court three to get their seat, to wait 2 hours before we walked on court, and we kind of looked at each other and said, whoa, these people are up for this, you know, it was really exciting, got us really up for playing, because if these people are that keen that they want to wait there for 2 hours to watch us play, then we better play well.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's a good analogy. That's why Wimbledon, you know, you always felt like when you drove up, and you saw the lines of people, and people had obviously been queuing up and sleeping overnight. It made you feel very special. It made you feel like maybe some people in this line have come to actually watch you play, you know, and it certainly gave you a buzz more than the other slams in that way, I think, that it just made you feel very special as a player, and particularly in doubles, even today, when, you know, they're not that many names in doubles. It's the only slam, really, that actually treats doubles players with respect in terms of when the matches are played, when the finals are played, the audience. It's always full on the center court, number one. When the doubles, people don't leave like they do in the other Grand Slam. So I think particularly for doubles as well, that Wimbledon is by far the best of the slam.
Was that the one you always wanted to win then, Peter?
Well, we wanted to win them all, you know, but it was always nice to win, that's for sure.
Yeah. And I know that obviously you're a big golfer as well, Peter, aren't you?
Well, a big golfer. You mean I'm a tall golfer? You know, I mean, I like to play. I'm, you know, not especially good, but it's I have a bunch of buddies that have a lot of fun with, so it's nice, yeah.
We had Todd Martin on the other day, as I said, and
no, Todd's a
I know he
golfer.
Plays golf. How is he? And Tim, he plays with Tim Henman, so they must be good golfers, right?
Well, Tim's yeah, the best golfer among tennis players, and or at least he was. I think he's he was certainly a plus handicap. So he would expect to shoot better than par every time he plays. And Todd, I think, was probably a three or a four, and then the rest of us are somewhat less than that.
That's nicely put.
I know, John, you play golf as well, and you've played golf, I know, with the President of the United States, haven't you?
I have, yes. That's not the easiest to play with Mr. Trump, because he likes to play around in about 2 hours, and he doesn't like you to hit practice shots, and so you're in a complete rush the whole time. And I'm a lousy golfer at the best of times. So, yeah, there's a lot of pressure when you play. I haven't played with him for a number of years, and my golf has got worse, if that's possible. So I probably won't be getting an invite very often, you know, in the near future, that's for sure.
There must be similarities between the game technically and perhaps mentally as well, aren't there, guys?
Well, I mean, they are. And actually, to be honest, I'm probably about the worst golfer out of the tennis players. Not that I play regularly, but most tennis players are under 10 and under handicap. I'm not. I've never have been and probably never will be. But most tennis players are pretty good at golf overall. I mean, there's some pretty solid ones out there. I tell you, it's amazing. I don't know where they get the time. I'm talking about guys that are even on the tour are under 10s. I don't know where they get the time to play to get to that handicap, but there's a lot of good ones out there.
Well, there are. I think there are a lot of guys who are just natural, you know, have natural hand-eye coordination. And, you know, I don't think I fit in the top of that ranking list. But you know, you practice. I go out in the range. I really enjoy going to the driving range. And you know, you can reach a certain level just through sheer, you know, hard work. And I think that's why, you know, older tennis players like golf, because, you know, because we can't run anymore. And so it's, you know, at least you can still, you know, it's one step before snooker.
I'm a snooker fan, actually. But just going back to your partnership with John McEnroe, you know, you said it was very much win as a team, lose as a team. But you did admit that there was a slight element of you that was annoyed at the fact that everyone wanted to talk about him. He got all the attention, if you like, which kind of indicates it wasn't quite a 50-50 relationship. Did you feel that you had to prove yourself when you were with him on court, Peter?
Well, you know, the first, say, 2 years that we played together, it was very much a 50-50 partnership. You know, I would say that, you know, back in that period of time, we played 8 times in singles, and, you know, he was 5-3. So we were, you know, we were pretty close. And that's probably when, you know, I'm 4 years older, though. And so everybody, you know, he was this bright young star and everyone wanted to talk about him. And, you know, I was kind of like, well, wait a second. You know, what, don't you want to talk about me? No. But once there was a period there when my form dropped, you know, I had some injuries and I just wasn't as good anymore. And then it was pretty much just, hey, I'm lucky to be a part of this partnership, you know. So if they want to talk about him, I understand.
What do you think? I know I mentioned a couple of weeks ago when we had Mark Woodford on, and we've talked about doubles. And I had the pleasure, it probably wasn't a pleasure for you, to have a hit with you a few years ago. I don't know if you remember, because I've shaved my locks off during lockdown. But yeah, I had the pleasure of doing so. And I remember in a changing room, you said to me, if the singles players were out there playing doubles, they'd dominate, no question.
Yes. If they actually took it seriously, because they're the best players. You know, you know, you do see the top guys go out and play doubles occasionally, but they haven't practiced and they don't really understand the game like, say, the Bryan brothers or any of those top guys. And so so they'll often lose. It was the same way when Lendl used to play doubles. You know, Lendl didn't really care and he wasn't that good at it. And so, you know, okay, he's not great, but if those great players, you know, practiced and wanted to get good, you know, they would have.
Yeah.
I know that John and myself, we discussed it with Mark a couple of weeks ago, and we both felt, me as a fan and you guys as the players, felt that doubles points should be amalgamated with the singles so that the singles players are compelled to play doubles.
It would be good. They tried that in the juniors, didn't they? amalgamating the rankings, and I guess it just never caught on. It's tough to change a culture in midstream, because the guys now, you know, when do you do it? The old guys are just never going to go for that, and the old guys basically run the tour. Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic, they still basically run the tour. You know, it's what they say doesn't necessarily go, but they have a lot of sway. And so, you know, Rafa actually is a very good doubles player, but you know, he only plays, what, 5 or 6 weeks a year? And the other two guys just don't care. And so I can't see how the, you know, how any sort of change like that could take place. It is a shame, because from a tournament promoter's perspective, you know, every time John and I played, the court was packed. So we were a draw, just the same as all the top singles guys. And so the fact that they're the top names don't play doubles anymore is a real setback for the tournaments. I mean, it does cost them the tour and the promoters. It costs them money having fewer draw cards.
Yeah, definitely, no doubt about that. You're absolutely right. And as we've talked about it, Keith, you know, the ironic part is that when you go to a tournament, you know, and the audience comes out to watch the singles, 75%.
Can't hear you at the moment, John.
You've lost me?
Yeah, we lost you. I think what you said was that the majority of players, particularly come to tennis, play doubles but only want to watch singles.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, listen, I mean, we've discussed it. Actually, I must tell you, Peter, because I spoke to somebody today who was getting coaching by a guy here in London who you played, I think, in one of your first ever Wimbledon doubles match. I don't know if you remember. He asked me to ask you. A guy called Bobby Wilson.
No, I didn't play Bobby. Bobby played mixed doubles against John McEnroe. I don't remember ever playing against him, no.
Maybe I got it wrong. Do you remember him, John?
Sure, yeah. Bobby was a very talented, a bit before my time. I never got to play him or anything, but he was a very talented player that, you know, perhaps if mentally had been a bit stronger, would have, you know, won more matches than he did. I mean, he had a successful career, but he was a very gifted player, and it was a pretty good era when he played. He was a top player.
Hey, John, what's it like working with these guys? Obviously, you work with Peter and with John McEnroe. What's it like working with them?
Well, just to go back about hearing me, I commentate with Peter at Queen's, or we don't commentate, but we're in the studio and it's always fun. But when I commentate with his friend John McEnroe, you know, well, I never say a word with him because I'm always nervous and he likes to talk anyway. But a lot of people always say that's my best commentary. Say I'm always very understated when I work with Johnny Mac. So, yeah, maybe there's a lesson for me there.
Is he that intimidating a character, guys? We've got to get him on here, by the way.
He's a strong character. There's no question about that. Yeah, and he doesn't necessarily suffer fools gladly. So if you get in there and you want to mix it up with him, then you're in for a rough time.
Indeed. Tell me, Peter, obviously I know you and John are great pundits. You must have been missing the tour. And, of course, there's no Wimbledon at the moment. Who do you think would have won the men's and women's had there been a tournament? Or is it just too difficult to say because we haven't had any proper play for several months?
Well, I think that obviously Federer wouldn't have played because he, you know, he's injured. Rafa, I think, you know, always takes a bit longer to round in form. You know, he was a bit like Bjorn back in our day, where Bjorn needed weeks to sort of round into top form, and then he was, you know, obviously amazing. I think Djokovic would have been the favorite, certainly. Obviously, he's number one in the world, but also he's the sort of guy who can lock into a top level very quickly. And so, you know, I think that, it would have favored him. But again, you know, it's who knows? Who knows?
And the women's?
You know, what if they are actually going to start in August? I sure hope so, but it remains to be seen.
Go with that, John. I mean, what about the women's? We will see. We can't forget the women's.
Well, I would agree with Peter. I would have put Djokovic as the favourite, whether Federer or anybody else have played. But obviously, we're not going to know. The women, that's a lot tougher to predict because they're still at that level at the moment where, you know, you could pick 10 or 12 women that could win it. They still haven't got to that stage yet where, and maybe they never will do again, but where they've got these sort of three or four players that you could always pick that are going to win at one of the slams. At the moment, they're still at that level where these young players have not quite got the solidness where they can compete and play well in the slams back-to-backs. We've seen that with Osaka, who you know won a couple and then seems to have gone off the boil for a little bit. We've had that with Sloane Stephens. I don't know about Sofia Kenin. We'll soon find out there, hopefully at the US Open, see if she can carry her form from the Australian Open. But at the moment, we're sort of waiting for players to sort of take a hold of the women's game and to dominate. Obviously, Serena is still there, but the women's is very tough to predict, I think.
Yeah.
Peter, I know. Go on, you go ahead.
Well, you know, I'm not an expert in women's tennis, to be honest with you, because, you know, for so many years, I watched so much tennis, but it was all men's because that was just what I did. And so, you know, it was always nice to come to Wimbledon and see the women for a change. But I never would have called myself an expert in terms of, you know, who's in good form and who isn't. You know, it is interesting, women's game, that nobody has sort of has stepped up with that champions mentality that the Williams sisters had and Hingis had and you know, back, you know, Steffi and Selish and those great champions. Nobody seems to have you know, come to the fore. I mean, I think Coco Gauff is a strong possibility. She certainly seems to have a very strong mentality, but you know, nobody else really seems to be stepping up.
Yeah. I agree.
I mean, Halep's won a couple of slams. I mean, she's
she's
won Wimbledon last year. So
she's a great player and she's a great competitor. But she still gets nervous a bit, and so there will be days when she just doesn't have it. And you know, those the really great players seem to figure out a way to win when they're not playing well. And you know, none of the women seem to be able to do that these days.
Yeah, at the moment, I agree.
Do you think it's similar to some of the men coming up? Because, of course, we're still talking about the same three. When are the young guys going to step up? Tsitsipas, Shapovalov, Medvedev, Choric, all these young guns, they just haven't stepped up. Is it a similar kind of thing? There's got to be some sort of coincidence there.
Maybe. Maybe it is, you know, there. It's a little surprising, really, that nobody has stepped up consistently and just said, "I'm here and I'm ready to knock you off." I mean, team made some nice progress last year. I think you know, working with his new coach, who is his coach now?
Masu.
Yeah. Nicolas Masu has done a really nice job with him, I think, and has progressed his game in the last 12 months. And so while I always sort of thought the team was stagnating and maybe wouldn't, you know, ever get to the top, he now looks as though, well, maybe he does have a chance to do that. He's certainly works hard enough.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that team might be a, you know, just a good player on clay, and we may see him sneak one slam perhaps, but I wasn't sure either, but I, watching the Australian Open this year, he looks like he's added things to his game, and he's right up in that mix now of you know, one of the four or five perhaps that, you know, could take over or could start winning some slams if these three you know, take a step back, which I don't know how long that is before that's going to happen, but he's definitely got a chance now, no doubt about it.
Just before you go, Peter, I don't want to keep you too long, but obviously we are at the time of Wimbledon. And, of course, I know BBC are showing a lot of the old matches. There's one match that sticks in my mind. John knows that I talked about it, which I doubt they will replay. But to me, I just remember being at a tennis club in London playing and watching that game. A tennis club called Shandos, you probably know it. And this match that I saw was just Jimmy Connors against Mikhail Pernfors. It just sticks in my mind as the greatest comeback I have ever seen. What match sticks in your mind for Wimbledon, guys?
You know, so many. You know, over the years, just from the British perspective, you know, Andy has played so many amazing matches, you know, coming back from two sets to love down against a whole bunch of players. Tim Henman, same, had so many amazing matches. That match against Harhaus, what was it? I can't remember what the score was in the fifth, 16-14 or something.
17-15 or something, yeah.
You know, there are so many great matches over the every year there will be, you know, three or four unbelievable matches that you just think, wow, this is, we're lucky to be able to watch it. Of course, John and I, or at least I beg your pardon, I don't necessarily get to watch any of those because I'm out on court 12, you know, commentating on some doubles match, you know.
And me too. Unfortunately, that's what I'm doing these days. But I actually, Keith, I like your Connors Pernfors match. I must say that was, and the reason being was that I had quite a bit of money on that match and I backed Jimbo. And I had quite a bit of money on it. In those days, you were allowed to bet for about 2 years. Players were allowed to bet before they stopped it. And I remember actually giving up on Jimbo, which I shouldn't have done at two sets to love down, and what was he, 4-1 down in the third, I think he was, or 4-love or whatever.
6-1, 6-1, 4-1.
I went into a restaurant in Wimbledon. I thought, oh, well, that's the end of that go. Yeah, that's right. And I thought, that's the end of that. And I was eating upstairs, and the fellow who ran the restaurant was a mate of mine. He came down and said, Jimmy's on a comeback. I said, no, he's gone. He said, no, he's not. And by the time I finished my meal, got down there, it was 2-1, and I stayed and then watched it. And Jimmy paid for a lot of meals that night. So I was very happy with that one, I must say.
Well, listen, I love talking to you guys. Peter, you are a legend of the game, and you're known as a gentleman.
How times change.
You are regarded as a gentleman with a dry sense of humour. But the one thing I just wanted to ask you, with your partnership with McEnroe, knowing the kind of differences in the personalities, do you ever feel a bit embarrassed that I'm associated with his behaviour because I'm tarred with the same brush? Did you ever have that feeling?
No, because in fact, what people don't realise is that when we first started to play together, I was pretty much a hothead as well. It was the second tournament we ever played together. And we played, it was in San Francisco in the semifinals. And we played McNair and Stewart. And it was a tight in the third set. And I complained about a call. You know, I thought they hit a serve, there was a fault, and I missed the return. And I went to the umpire. Come on, you can't possibly call that one good. And I swear I had tread marks on my back where John climbed over me to try and strangle the umpire. And we lost. Well, you know, the next service game, we lost serve, and we lost the match 6-4 in the third. And that night, I remember just thinking about it. You know what? If I don't keep myself together, if I don't sort of just be the anchor, then we're going to lose a lot of matches like this because all hell will break loose. And so from that point on, when we played doubles, I was the calm one. And yet when I would go play singles, I'd be a lunatic again and lose. So, hello, someone in there, you're part of the best team in the world in doubles and you're calm. And you're a lunatic in singles and your ranking's dropping like a stone. Maybe. Can you draw any correlations there? Nah.
Actually, actually, one last thing, Peter. Just really, Keith, Peter probably knows this, but and I've told Keith this story on another podcast, but, you know, tennis players are obsessed with records like we all are. And I don't know if Peter knew that. I mean, I'm sure you've got plenty of records in the game, but one that you and I share that probably will never be broken again is in, God, I'm so bad with dates. I can't remember when I won the mixed doubles back-to-back. I think it was 80-81 with Wendy Turnbull. But anyway, whatever those 2 years were. Those 2 years, John McEnroe won the singles and Martina won the singles. You and Mac won the doubles. Martina and Shriver won the doubles. And Wendy and I won it. And then the next year, all five of us repeated. So it was 2 years in a row. 83, 84. Oh, okay. Well, I got close. I was only 2 years off. So that record, I don't think will be ever broken again. So that's one record that I've got that hopefully will never be broken anyway. It's not a huge one, but what the hell, it's a record.
There you go.
Just one other thing about Wimbledon, guys. First of all, you, Peter, as an American, when you used to come and play at Wimbledon, did you used to think, wow, this place is pompous? I mean, this all-white business, what a load of nonsense. Tell us your honest opinion about it when you first turned up.
Well, yeah, you know, it was a little stiff back in the late 70s when I started. And yeah, I think a lot of Americans probably thought that a little bit. It took a little while. Of course, you know, dating a British girl didn't hurt. You know, it sort of allowed me to open my mind that okay, perhaps, you know, different people around the world think differently. And you know, I came to appreciate the British perspective on a lot of things. And you know, I think, you know, when we first came over, or when I first came over, it seemed like everyone was, you know, oh, why do you do that? That sounds stupid. Well, it's traditional. And I thought that's such a stupid, you know, reason. But of course, traditions are powerful things, and they're really nice things. And so I guess I've sort of come round to your way of thinking to a large extent.
John?
Well, I mean, I thought Peter was very diplomatic there. As an American, I, as a Brit, I thought it was pompous. And when I first started there, and I always thought that it was, at the start, it got better. But the club was basically, it was almost annoyed when players came for Wimbledon. It was almost like, okay, you're here, please play. And then if you lose, get the heck out of the grounds, because we don't want sort of the rabble here. I thought that it was a very uninviting club at that stage. And thankfully, it has got better. There have been younger members that have come in, and it's not so much of the old school tie nonsense that it used to be. And it's improved a lot as a club. Thank goodness for that, because I thought it was a nightmare in my early career. I actually couldn't stand it, to be honest. Only I went there for the 2 weeks of Wimbledon and never went back any other times unless I absolutely had to.
Well, listen, you guys are members of the club, so maybe you can be inviting and invite me along sometime. But anyway, that's beside the point. I just want to, how did it happen, Peter? You know, John lives in the States, you're American and you live in London. I know Boris Becker lives in London, Pat Cash lives in London. I think Stefan Edberg also lives in London. Why do so many players decide to live in London? Or maybe they want to stick close to that tennis roots, the Wimbledon All England club. What is it about? Is it about that? Tell us.
It's a great city, you know, plain and simple. I think a lot of guys just come here because it's you know, it's convenient. You know, people speak English here, and it's in Europe, and so you know, I guess I came here just. Because we lived a bit in New York, and we lived a bit here in London, and I like London better than New York, plain and simple, you know. And so that was the one by default, really.
John, what about you? You've already broken the mold. You've gone the other direction.
Well, I've gone the other direction quite simply because I like to see the sun. That's it.
I completely understand.
Not too complicated, but I listen. I love London too. I'm a big London fan, but I like it from about May through till about September. In an ideal world, it'd be nice to have two houses, but unfortunately, that may not ever happen again. So I like the hot weather. That's just me. What can I say?
Well, listen, Peter, thank you so much for coming on. You know, I've mentioned it here on this podcast when I was not even 14 yet. I managed to get on court one at the end of the day to see you and Johnny Mack play doubles. And you were playing Mel Purcell and Vincent Van Patten. And I was sitting right behind the umpire. And I was 13 at the time and thought, oh, this is fantastic. I felt nervous sitting so close to you guys. And now I'm here talking to you on Zoom. And it's great. What can I say? Thank you so much, Peter.
No, thank you. My pleasure.
And hopefully we can do Take it again. Care, and you tell Johnny Mack he's got to get on this podcast, because this is the podcast. It's rock and roll, and he's rock and roll, and you were rock and roll. And maybe still are. I don't know. Thank you so much, Peter.
No, my
brother. Keep safe and well, okay?
Yeah, thank you.
Take care.
And you.
Well, thanks a lot, John. Yet again, another great week. John's not around over the next couple of weeks. Of course, he's captaining the San Diego Aviators in World Team Tennis. So, all being well, John will be back in a few weeks. But do not fret. We've got some great interviews lined up. One of them with the likes of former world number one Gustavo Kuerten, one of my favourite all-time players. So, we look forward to that, of course. Apart from that, we'll see you next time. Please remember to press that subscribe button and share with all your friends. You can also follow us on Twitter, RNR_tennis, and of course on Instagram, rock'n'roll_tennis. And please leave us a review. We'd love to hear your comments. We will, of course, see you next week, as always. Thanks so much again.